Nice to see you again.
Nice to see you too. You look very well. It's been a while
Oh.
since we recorded our last
It
podcast.
is. Winter's always busy, is it
It
not?
is.
So today we're going to do a podcast from the PDCriticon conference, which was at the end of last year in Pune. I was very lucky to be invited as a speaker there. And whilst I was there, I recorded a few podcasts. This one is with Bala Ramachandran, who works in Chennai. He's a consultant in intensive care there. And he gave a really nice talk about individualized and personalized medicine, which intrigued me and is right up my street.
I agree absolutely. I think he decided to not use personalized, but decided that precision was more appropriate, which perhaps is right. It's the thing that Barack Obama introduced in 2015. He paid the NIH or whatever it is a huge amount of money to try and start the ball rolling as far as precision medicine was concerned. And I think his talk was very, very good. I really enjoyed it.
So it's interesting the difference between precision medicine and personalized medicine, which Bala goes into and discusses in our conversation. It's a bit of a nuance there, isn't it?
There is, yeah. I think what he talks about personalized is the way it's being interpreted by a lot of people. I.e., people feel that personalized means the treatment is geared towards that individual rather than the cohort of individuals with similar conditions around. And that's the reason why the term precision has become a little bit more appropriate in this situation.
Because actually, everything we do should be geared towards the cohort of people with that condition, because that's what, when we read a paper and look at the outcomes, the first question in our PICO is population, isn't it? So what patients did they look at? Are they appropriate? Are they applicable and translatable to the patients who we see? And if
Absolutely.
not, then that paper has no meaning for our patients.
I think precision is becoming more relevant because we are starting to look at the genetics and the genomics of individuals. And although fashionable to talk about, I looked up some figures. There have been something like 200 clinical trials in sepsis where they have looked at the response to sepsis, looking at the various cytokines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and then given these individuals appropriate anti-cytokine treatments around. And the figure is really quite worrying because of the 200 studies, I don't think any one of them have shown any benefit. So I think in that sense, we are still in the ICU setup in conditions like sepsis, we are pretty still stuck with using old-fashioned treatments, haven't we?
Been having a variety of studies. I mean, one of my colleagues was involved in a study like this 15 plus years ago, wasn't he?
Absolutely.
And it all looked so fantastic. You run a quick blood test and work out exactly what this patient needs, and that's the cocktail. And yet, sadly, the reality hasn't yet come through to bedside medicine.
Now, and as far as bedside medicine, I think he talked about septicide as the toy that could be used at the bedside to arrive at an earlier diagnosis. And there was a paper that was published in the American Journal of Critical Care Medicine in 2018. So it's admittedly 6 years ago. But the conclusion of the paper was that this particular tool was able to discriminate between SARS and sepsis. And this is where you have to explain to me. With area under ROC of between 0.82 and 0.89, indicating probability of infection.
Which is very good. That's very high to have an ROC 0.89. Excellent.
But one of the interesting things they talked about was that this was combined with the demographics, clinical and lab data, et cetera, which I think normally when you and I see a sick patient and we have a patient with fever and tachycardia and high white count or neutropenic patient in a septic stage, we would probably be pretty good at arriving at a diagnosis of a bacterial or infective sepsis.
Right. What's for this package of tests? What was their gold standard?
I don't know. And I talked it over with one of our virologists at the Queen's, and they don't use this septicide. And he said, well, it was just yet another tool. Perhaps we ought to invite somebody from septicide to come and talk to us. But our colleague wasn't particularly enamored. He said, you know, there are an awful lot of these gadgets around where it can tell you that there is ongoing inflammatory reaction around.
Yeah.
But it doesn't tell you whether it's bacterial or it's inflammatory due to trauma or whatever it is. It's very difficult.
I was once at a meeting and there's a very excited researcher who had a new test which would show with great accuracy in inflammatory bowel disease whether a patient was having an exacerbation. Yeah? And they showed all of the data, how the area on the curve was excellent and how it was highly sensitive to show ongoing exacerbations. And I put my hand up and said, why don't you just ask the patients?
Yeah, increased diarrhea, blood intake, etc.
And there's a bit of a pause as everyone digested the efficacy of just saying, are you having an exacerbation? So, you know, if the gold standard for diagnosing sepsis is fever and shock, then we may not need a test if that's the gold standard.
No, and it, in that situation where there's bacterial or other conditions which gives rise to sepsis, in clinical terms, it becomes irrelevant because I think chances are our standard therapy of antibiotics, inotropes, fluids, etc., will continue to remain. I think we're not going to sort of say, look, this sounds unlikely to be bacterial, so we withdraw antibiotics.
Yeah, and that though differs. What I'm talking about is the sepsis syndrome. Yeah,
absolutely.
Which differs to, does this patient have an infection which is driving this deterioration or whatever? And that's a different question. Yes, 100%. That does need testing, and that's why we use white counts and CRPs and procalcitonins, etc. But having diagnosis of sepsis syndrome is, to my mind, still a clinical issue in almost every case. Anyway, let's run the tape in old language and see what Bala had to say about precision medicine, and then we can chat again afterwards.
Okay.
Good afternoon. Welcome to another PicPod. I'm sitting here in the lovely city of Pune in India at the 2023 Pedicriticon conference, which is the national Indian PICU conference. I'm sat here with Bala Ramachandran, who is from Chennai, who's just given us a really good talk about precision and personalised medicine. So Bala, please could you introduce yourself and tell us who you are?
Hi Patrick, thank you so much for having me on this program. I'm a pediatric intensivist in Chennai, which is in the southeastern coast of India, formerly known as Madras. And I've been practicing there for about 20 years now. And this is actually our 25th annual conference, so it's a very special event for us. Things have been going really well here. Thank you once again for having me on the program.
Well, the conference is fantastic, and I'm really happy to be here, and I'm learning lots. You spoke to us about precision and or personalized medicine. So what's the difference between precision medicine and personalized medicine?
For the most part, people use these two terms identically, but there is a subtle difference. The original term was personalized medicine, but then people started to think that this means that we're going to make a treatment for one individual. That is done in some situations, but more often than not, we try to identify a subset of patients who would respond better to some treatment and then devise a treatment for that particular subset. So that is called precision medicine. And the preferred term nowadays is to say precision medicine rather than personalized medicine, because people obviously think if it's personalized medicine, oh, it's only going to help a few individuals. No, it's not like that. Precision medicine is meant for a large, larger population.
When we're treating a patient, we have one patient in front of us. Mm-hmm. That patient requires, demands, and deserves the best treatment for them. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't mind what happens to the other 99 patients in the trial. They only care about them. So the end point of all our treatment is personalized medicine. And precision care in the personalized nature of making everything right for that one patient in front of us.
Mm-hmm. I see where you're getting. The thing is, it's not that we're going to treat only groups of people, but it's how we can treat that one patient better. Right now in traditional medicine, it's basically a one-size-fits-all concept. We have a particular disease, lung injury, pneumonia, ARDS. Everybody gets the same, essentially the same kind of treatment. Might be the same antibiotics, might be the same kind of ventilation, with little, differences here and there. But the problem is, not everyone will respond the same way to the same treatment. Some people will get better. Some people will not get better, and some people will have adverse reactions to the treatment. So the whole idea of precision medicine is to try and see how we can tailor the treatment to a particular group of patients who would respond to it better, so that one, you give them more targeted treatment. Two, if you determine that this particular patient is not going to respond, then you don't give them that treatment, thereby you're avoiding the costs associated with it, and more importantly, you're avoiding the side effects associated with it.
I'm glad you mentioned lung injury, because you had some fantastic examples of that in your talk. And back in PICPOD 58, we spoke to Heidi Flory about PARDS, and we discussed whether that is one condition or multiple conditions under one umbrella. And in that it's multiple conditions, we feel, then the treatment has to be different as well, depending on the condition and then also depending on the patients. So could you go through the examples which you gave of when treatments were divergent in their efficacy and in their benefits in this NPARDS?
Absolutely. We have always known that ARDS, lung injury, is not a single entity. It's very heterogeneous. And even within the same patient, you have areas which are heterogeneous. But we tend to treat all of them identically. And so it's no surprise that some of them respond, but a large majority do not respond. If you think about it, we haven't really had any big breakthroughs in ARDS treatment since the low tidal volume studies, which are now almost 15 or 20 years old. Everything else that has been studied since then has not been shown to have much efficacy. But it's only now we're learning that maybe we're applying our treatments to the entire cohort, whereas you have to try and fine-tune which set of patients will respond better. And I'll give you some examples of this. See, for instance, in 2015, you had the big Floralee trial come out from France, where they put adults with ARDS in the emergency room on either HFNC or NIV or just plain oxygen. And what they showed was HFNC resulted in a decrease in mortality in those patients with a PF ratio less than 300, and also a decrease in the intubation rate in those patients with a PF ratio less than 200. So this is what we call an example of predictive enrichment. You're predicting that a particular subset of patients will respond better to an intervention. And in this case, the subset is patients with PF ratio less than 300. The intervention is HFNC. And so this was a very large study, which it was actually practice changing. And so now we know that if the patient comes to you with ARDS, put them on HFNC. If they've are have a low PF ratio, and the chances are that they will do a little bit better. But if you look at the two studies which looked at the response to neuromuscular blockade, the first study, the Acuracis trial, came out in the New England Journal in 2010, and it showed that there was a decreased mortality with neuromuscular blockade. So after that, everybody started using neuromuscular blockade routinely in patients with ARDS, even in children, having the data extrapolated from the adults. But then come 2019, the ROSE trial found that there were no differences between whether you give them neuromuscular blockers or you don't give them neuromuscular blockers. So the bottom line is, we don't know which kind of a patient with ARDS will respond better. So you actually need better, what we call prognostic enrichment. You have to prognosticate, saying that if a patient fits into such and such a category, that particular group of patients might respond better to neuromuscular blockade. So going on with this, we're only now beginning to understand the and being able to classify the different types of ARDS. We've always known that you have, you know, pulmonary and extrapulmonary, you have mild, moderate, severe, etc. But now you're getting more biomarker-based classifications where you can look at certain biomarkers in the bowel fluid and then identify which stage of ARDS they're on. Once you're able to do that, you can then try and target interventions to that particular stage. But the really the most exciting breakthrough, I would say, came from the studies of Susan Calfee in 2014. She used a technique called latent class analysis, which uses both clinical data and biomarkers. And she divided ARDS into two groups. So one group had increased inflammatory markers, such as IL-8, IL-9, soluble TNF receptor 1, and decreased protein C, and she called this group as the hyperinflammatory group as opposed to the hypoinflammatory group. And what she found was that patients in the hyperinflammatory group had a mortality which was twice as high, so which is very significant. It sort of makes sense, you know, they have more inflammation, more interleukins, chemokines, etc. being released, so they're sicker and the mortality is higher. Now, this particular latent class analysis, or LCA, is a rather complicated process, and it's not that easy for everybody to do at the bedside. So she came up with an even simpler parsimonious model, which uses only the IL-8 levels, the bicarbonate levels, protein C levels, and whether or not the patient uses vasopressors. And what she showed was just using these four parameters was able to classify the patients with ARDS into hyper and hypoinflammatory groups just as accurately. So this is very exciting because it's so much easier to do and so much cheaper to do. You can do it almost at the bedside. So how does this help us? She applied her model to pre-existing studies of ARDS. If you look at the alveoli trial, which studied high versus low PEEP in ARDS, it showed that there was no difference between the groups. But then when Calfee looked, applied the her process to them, what was shown was if you looked at the hyperinflammatory group and used high PEEP on them, they had a lower mortality than the group which used low PEEP. Whereas if you did the same with the hypoinflammatory group, then using higher PEEP on them resulted in a higher mortality. So essentially what we're saying is, even though the large alveoli trial showed no difference when you used a high or low PEEP, there are certain populations where the higher PEEP will be beneficial, and there are certain populations where it will result in a higher mortality. And the key is trying to determine which group will benefit. So that's what, you know, these kind of subdivisions are useful. There are many more examples on this. There was the HARP 2 trial in the New England Journal in 2014, which studied simvastatin in ARDS and showed that there was no difference in mortality. But then when retrospectively this group was divided into hypo and hyperinflammatory, what was shown that using simvastatin in the hyperinflammatory group resulted in a lower mortality. So maybe this is something that needs to be studied now using simvastatin or something similar in just, you know, a more homogeneous group of patients. There are many more examples. The FACT trial of fluids, liberal versus conservative fluid management in ARDS 2006 showed no difference, but the same thing which when Susan Calfee's model was applied to that, it was shown that the hyperinflammatory group had a lower mortality when they got more fluids. They were in the liberal fluid regimen, whereas the hypoinflammatory group actually did worse if they were in the more fluid regimen. So there are many ways we can, we can apply these classifications, and we're basically trying to tailor an intervention better to a subgroup of patients rather than give it to the entire group. And that's what we're saying. We're trying to be more precise in our approach.
When we're doing journal club and doing critical appraisal of papers, the first question always asked is this population relevant to my patients? Yeah. Or actually, I should say, the first question asked is it relevant to my patients? We should be asking, is this relevant to my patients? And what we're talking about here is being more intelligent about what we're saying the population is. The population isn't patients with ARDS, which is this very, to me, unsatisfactory diagnosis of the x-ray has gone white after a few days after something else. That's very vague, isn't it? That's not a pathophysiological process. That's just an x-ray which has gone a bit hazy. So we need to be smarter and more accurate about defining the population for any study, and then working out whether our patient in front of us is a part of that accurate population. So when talking about precision medicine, is it actually talking about precision populations for studies?
Absolutely. We're trying to identify those individuals in a larger population who are in some way different, the disease is in some way different in them, even though we tend to lump the disease into one big group. We now understand that the diseases are not, you know, just one big group, but there are smaller groups in them depending on so many variables. There are genomic variables in them, there are environmental variables, even things like diet can affect that. So we're trying to better identify and subdivide these patient populations into a group and say that this group will respond better to this particular treatment, whereas the other groups will not respond. So let me not waste my time and money and energy on them. Let me try and help this particular group, and let me look at what can be used for the other groups. So that's the whole, you know, the essence of precision or personalized medicine.
Sonal just gave a talk about high-frequency oscillatory ventilation, and again, we discussed the papers, the OSCAR and the oscillate trial, but there's a subsequent analysis of those which showed that at worse oxygenation indices, the non-benefit or the increased risk of death reverses. So it does have benefit in the worst patients, in the rescue patients, rather than the standard patients. And again, that's all about picking your population, isn't it? About should you be oscillating patients who are just standard ventilator patients, mm-hmm. or should you reserve it only for the extremely sick rescue patients mm-hmm. who can't tolerate conventional ventilation? Mm-hmm. Sepsis is a big topic in precision medicine, mm-hmm. and there's lots of things we can look at to define our population better in that. So you mentioned genomics, and mm-hmm. That's just one part of it, but what's the way to be more precise about our septic patients?
Again, you know, we have tried so many interventions to treat septic patients, but really other than antibiotics and fluids, nothing significantly useful has come out despite spending millions and millions of dollars on research and therapies. But we are now understanding things a little bit better, especially with, as you mentioned, genomics. The Hector Wong, who was, you know, who can be regarded as the big guru of genomic medicine, precision medicine, and septic shock research at the University of Cincinnati Children's Hospital, has done so much work on this with biomarkers, etc. It's unfortunate that he passed away last year unexpectedly. But from his lab, so much work has come out. For instance, he devised what he called the PERSEVERE model, which is a pediatric risk in severe sepsis. And they took a group of children with severe sepsis and looked at the mRNAs expressing expression for more than 100 genes, which related to adaptive immunity and the glucocorticoid receptor signaling. And based on this, he divided these patients into two what he calls endotypes. Endotype A, where the gene expression for these genes was reduced, and then endotype B, where they had normal gene expression. And then what he showed was that if you gave steroids to these patients, those who had endotype A with the reduced gene expression had a 4 times higher mortality. And if you gave it to the endotype B, there was no increase in mortality, but they actually had some benefit. There was a lower risk of a complicated course. There was no improvement in mortality, but they had less risk of a complicated course. Unfortunately, this PERSEVERE model is rather complicated. You have to look at 100 genes, and these are all, you know, research information. It's not easily available at the bedside. I should also state that he took the same PERSEVERE model and applied it to adults with septic shock as well. He did a secondary analysis of the VAST study, the vasopressin and septic shock study. And again, he showed that the patients who had endotype A with the reduced gene expression had a much higher mortality than those with endotype B. In endotype B, there was no improvement in mortality. But in endotype A, clearly they did worse. So that would be a group of patients you do not want to give steroids to. Right now, even though everybody won't admit it, almost all of us would end up using steroids in septic shock out of desperation. But now, if you look at these data, it sort of tells you that, hey, listen, you may or may not help your patient, but there is a group of patients who you might actually hurt. And so it's, you know, we need better ways of identifying that particular group. So he actually came up, because the PERSEVERE 1 was a much more complicated model, and the results are not easily available at the bedside, he came up with what they call a PERSEVERE 2 model, which was published in the Pediatric Critical Care Medicine this year. And it's a score based on just 5 biomarkers and the platelet count. They use things like IL-8 levels, matrix metallopeptidase, and some other markers such as that. And they divided them into low and high risk groups. And then when they analyzed the patients, children with septic shock who had been and not been given steroids, the patients in the low risk group, there was no change in the mortality when they got steroids. But in the high-risk group, they had a 4 times higher mortality. So again, this tells you that even though the patients look the same to you, they are not the same. There are so many variations in gene expression, and some of them, steroids may not do anything, but in others, steroids would actually result in a higher mortality. So this is something you want to think about next time you're at the bedside of a patient with steroids, who have a patient with sepsis who's not responding, and you're thinking, oh, maybe I should put them on steroids.
So steroids and sepsis, either they did nothing or made mortality 4 times more likely. So there's a bit of a message there about steroids and sepsis, isn't it? You also mentioned that dexmedetomidine and vasopressin receptors are gene-based. So there are high expressors and low expressors. So there are patients who are relatively resistant to those.
So there are many drugs that we use regularly in the ICU where there is a significant genomic effect, where they're affected by SNPs or single nucleotide polymorphisms. These include opioids, clopidogrel, which the adults use far more often than we do, Coumadin, succinylcholine, etc. In fact, now the FDA has genomic information on more than 250 drugs in the package insert. And the genomics have been used for a very long time in oncology. In the ICU, we're just starting to see that. What's been shown is if, you know, vasopressin has been tried in septic shock now for resistant patients. But there are some patients who have an SNP near the vasopressin receptor gene, and these patients are at a much higher risk of adverse drug reactions, including necrosis of the limb, etc. Similarly, dexmedetomidine, which we use very frequently in the ICUs, there are some people who have a specific allele of the alpha-2 adrenoreceptor gene, and these patients show decreased efficacy with dexmedetomidine and increased time to effect. So next time you have a patient on whom you're giving dexmedetomidine and the patient's not responding, you might want to think maybe it's because he's got a genetic polymorphism which is making him do that. So there are many, many examples like this in medicine.
I am unashamedly scared of vasopressin. I've had a few patients who have given vasopressin to, and their limbs have become horrific. Are you telling me that I was just unlucky to have the patients who responded in that way because of their genomics, and that actually my colleagues around the world, around the country, who tell me they use vasopressin all the time, have just been lucky not to come across those patients?
No, not at all. We have to remember the genomic associations are from lab data. It's not available to us for routine use on a day-to-day basis. And the way somebody responds to a drug and the side effects, they are affected by many, many factors, not just a single, genomic factor. You know, depends on how sick they are, what are they sick with, what other medicines are they getting? Are they getting norepinephrine in addition to vasopressin? There's so many factors. So what happens is when we try vasopressin on a patient and they have side effects, very often we'll tend to say that, oh, the patient was sick anyway, I had to use this to save their life, so on and so forth. But we're beginning to get an understanding that patients will respond differently to different drugs based on many factors, one of which is a genomic factor.
You mentioned that these tests aren't available at the bedside. You mentioned the Septicite device, which is a bedside test which takes about an hour at bedside if you can afford the machine next to your bed. I looked it up straight after you said that, and it says that its main utility is to differentiate between infective inflammation and non-infective inflammation, which I wasn't too excited about when I read that, because the diagnosis at the time of arrival isn't important. It's the patient's status that is important in the medium term, but in the very short term, it's not. So what are the potential benefits of this Septicite device?
The Septicite is actually a very exciting new development. What it does is it's a rapid genomic analysis which measures the mRNA, four different mRNAs in blood, and looks at the expression, and then it tells you whether this patient is having a hyperinflammatory response because of an infection, or it is a hyperinflammatory response which is not because of an infection. And the sensitivity and specificity are really very good. They're more than 90% for both of them. And the best part is it's a little bedside test based on a cartridge, very little human intervention, and takes only about 1 hour for the results to be available. So this is something which is of a lot of potential use for us, because Let's look at a patient, maybe not at the time they present in the emergency room in fluoride shock, but you have a patient who's reasonably stable in the ICU, and then they spike fevers, and then they start having hypotension, etc. And you're worried, is this a secondary infection, or is it something else? Do I have to start pumping them with antibiotics, etc.? So in that sort of a scenario, a test like septicide would be extremely useful for us, because you can at least, you know, if it's negative, you can say, okay, well, maybe it's not an infection. I can withhold giving the antibiotics. So, you know, that way it would help you. Having said that, 15 years ago, we were saying the same thing about procalcitonin, but that has now fallen out of flavor. But we have come a long way, and you do get new developments such as septicide. So it remains to be seen how it will change our practice. But you know, newer things are available now.
If we look back 50 years or 100 years, imagine 100 years ago, we didn't even have antibiotics. Mm-hmm. Let's look 100 years to the future. When our patients arrive into the ED, do they give one drop of blood, which then spits out a diagnosis and B, an individually tailored treatment plan with doses and medicines immediately? Is that the future? Surely that's possible as we go forward with this.
I wish that would happen, but I don't think it'll be quite so simple. But you know, we are getting to be more precise. If you look at the course of the development of modern medicine, we are getting better, but there is still a long way to go. Yes, we do get a lot more information with, you know, from blood tests now, and we're getting them a lot faster. If you think about it, the Human Genome Project took 13 years to sequence the human genome and cost billions of dollars. Now you can get it done in less than a month and for a much cheaper price. And there are actually studies which have been done in the US and the UK where they've taken, you know, patients, children in the ICU, and given them rapid next generation sequencing and shown that the results are available very fast. Very fast could be a few days, but now that keeps on coming down. Now they say that you can even get the results in one day's time at a reasonable cost. And the results are such that they, you know, you actually tend to do an intervention based on them. So it is important. It's just not some research information. So there are a lot of exciting things that will come about. 10 years ago, it was very expensive to do genomic sequencing, whether you do a whole exome or a clinical exome or things like that, and it would take 45 days or it would take 2 months. Now we can get the results in 10 to 12 days for much cheaper, and this is only going to get better and better. So there are many things we can look forward to.
Well, if in the year 2123, A, the internet still exists, and B, MP3s are still readable, then who knows, maybe someone will listen to this long after we're gone and think about how right we were, or maybe how wrong we were, and the unimaginable future is very exciting, isn't it? Bala, thank you so much. That was really fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure being here.
Good stuff, wasn't it?
Oh, enjoyed it. Bala is such a good speaker, isn't it?
And his talk was really engaging, and afterwards we just chatted for ages, and I was lucky enough to be able to record it. I think, to me, you know, before we listened to Bala, we talked about some of the genomics aspects. I think in precision medicine, there's also the bedside monitoring aspects as well, which we use quite a lot, things like electrical impedance tomography and hemodynamic monitors. And it's amazing to see how much that does actually change management, and how we can individualize our therapies and be really precise. You know, so one of my favorite tests I do in a patient who is very unstable on the ventilator is I put on the electrical impedance on Tomography Belt and I look at their global expansion, and then I'll see what happens when they have an episode of suction. And it's amazing. Some patients, their lungs rebound to the pre-suction base volume within 5-6 breaths. And other patients, they take literally an hour to regain their pre-suction volume. And so you can change your management. Yeah, you can say for the patients with slow volume recoil, A, don't suction unless you have to, and B, use inline at all times, because inline I've shown that has less effect. And that kind of, you know, precise altering. We once had a patient, for instance, who I was asked to go and see, and they were 100% oxygen and ventilated and had some secretions, were having suction every half hour. And I showed that it took more than a half hour for them to regain their volumes. So actually what was happening was that we're incrementally decreasing the volumes. I said, just don't suction those patients. And within a couple of days, the oxygen had improved and everything was then on an improving trajectory.
And that's a very good description of personalized medicine, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that's physiology or pathophysiology in action. And here you are making decisions on that individual because you've got data which shows that suctioning is bad for him. Yeah. As you say, another patient would not do the same, behave in the same sort of way.
And if you look at, you know, almost any paper, if you look at the outcomes, there is a headline benefit, hopefully, for a therapy. Well, the headline benefit is the mean or the median effect. Now, on both sides of that effect, there'll be a bell-shaped curve. There'll be some patients who have twice as much effect, but there'll probably be some patients who have a negative effect. Yeah. But we say, as a population, it's okay because we are happy for the population on average to benefit. And yeah, we understand that some of them may get worse, but if 99 get better and one gets worse, then that's okay because that's all the data I have in front of me. But what happens if we could actually find the 1% and say, no, that patient will not have salbutamol for their asthma because they're the 1%? And that's really intriguing, isn't it? Because if we have enough information, if we can somehow work out, you know, studies often, we think that more patients are better. If the N is higher, it's a more powerful study. But isn't the ideal N for a study one?
Well, but that's personalized medicine again, isn't it?
Well, exactly. Because I don't care if there's a therapy which works on average. I don't care if it works for you, Hamish. I only care if it works for me.
No, I think that's, in a way, that there's a lot of truth in that. The trouble is that we don't have that huge amount of ability to fine-tune treatment towards an individual in an ICU. You have to sort of work very generically with patients with sepsis or patients with raised ICP or whatever it is. So they have to be very generic.
Do you think there'll come a time in the future when we will be able to be more specific and more precise?
I'm not being negative about Bala's talk. I think he was really very good. But I think there's a question of, one, where is it going to be provided? At the moment, a lot of personalized medicine or precision medicine is being provided by people who have a very good understanding of genetics and genomics, if we go in that area. So especially with malignancy, with complex sort of immunodeficiency disorders, etc., the understanding of genetics and genomics is desperately important. One of the things that I think perhaps if you're going to go that way, then medical students need to be introduced to this very early on in their training. As far as other aspects of personalized medicine is concerned, what I worry about is that it may be very possible in certain very well-funded units around, but there is the introduction of this sort of medicine has the problem of producing disparity in healthcare. You have people with limited resources who will never go there anyway. And for them, it will still be the old-fashioned medicine around. And the ones who are very well-funded will be able to go into, you know, precision medicine. Exacerbates the disparity even more so.
It does. And some of the equipment and the tests and the tools are extremely expensive, aren't they?
They are.
And with monitors costing tens and tens of thousands of pounds and consumables and the skills and everything. So that is an issue. But then won't there be a trickle-down effect where if this becomes effective and scalable, then it becomes cheaper and cheaper?
Yeah, well, I hope so. I hope Ronald Reagan's idea of trickle-down has never worked in economy. Whether it works in healthcare, perhaps, I don't know. I think you may be right that perhaps by introducing this, perhaps exposing physicians in resource-poor countries, they can, and getting the technological companies to go and make things, tools which are affordable, perhaps may make things move faster in resource-poor countries.
I'm often asked when I teach about cardiovascular physiology, and I talk about, you know, how preload and contractility, we need to have that balance. They have to be not imbalanced. You can't have more preload than the contractility can handle, or not enough preload for the said contractility. And then I have machines. I've got ultrasound. I've got hemodynamic monitors, and I can tell where we're at in their balance. And then I'm always asked the same question by my colleagues who don't have the machines and say, well, you know, how do we tell? And I just have to say, I don't know. I don't really know. Just be open to the idea that even though you would generally, for shock and sepsis, give fluid, maybe it's the wrong thing. So it's a state of mind as well, isn't it?
It is. Without those tools around, perhaps you have to go back to basic physiology, look at the peripheral circulation, look at the sort of thing that we used to do, look at capillary refill, look at blood pressures, look at saturations, look at the color of the patient. Yeah. So in that sense, this is what you would do even with those fantastic tools with you. The first thing you would do, Patrick, is probably look at the patient and sort of say, look, this chap is cold peripherally, he is, let's get all the various things on board.
Definitely so, but that will only tell me whether they are shocked or not shocked. It won't tell me whether it's due to insufficient myocardial contractility or insufficient preload at that point. Having the openness to say, well, I've tried this and it hasn't worked, is that because I've not tried it hard enough, or because I'm doing the wrong thing?
Well, that's where perhaps learning and teaching physiology will be very, very important, especially in places where these tools are not available.
Yeah, certainly. And everyone loves physiology.
No, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that, the Maitland study where they looked at the fee study. And this is it. I mean, that was a really good study where you looked at volume replacement and what it does to patients who are sick in a resource-poor setup.
Well, it does, but in the small print, it's volume replacement in patients who have a mean hemoglobin of 55. Yeah. So they were very anemic patients because presumably malaria is endemic in those regions.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a slight caveat there about whether that's due to oxygen delivery being diluted by the fluid, and so the effect is actually augmented by that.
I agree. Yeah, talking about malaria, you know, it's what is so fantastic is the vaccine that's arrived on the scene, and hopefully the impact in the sort of population that Maitland et al. Studied. Hopefully malaria would just disappear in that environment. I think it would be fantastic.
That'd
the
be
number one killer.
Remarkable, wouldn't it, if we can do that.
In terms of pediatric, is the number one killer still, isn't it?
Hope the malaria vaccine doesn't cause autism.
I don't think so. No. And I think one of the things that we know that in the US, the commonest cause of death is gunshot wounds, isn't it? Yeah. There's a paper from the New England Journal of Medicine.
Well, sadly, there's no vaccine for that.
No, no.
Going back to from our slight tangential walk there, going back to precision medicine, how can we make our practice more precise?
Difficult question. Have you any thoughts?
I think having that open mind, as I said, that ability to be change the path we're on, because when we think the patient is volume depleted, or we think that this therapy will work for this patient, and then having done so, don't just walk away and say, "I've now done this." I think having the ability to keep on watching, keep on questioning, saying what if I'm wrong? How do I move from now? I think that is the first step, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And also, I think educating trainees, educating clinicians that some of these tools are going to come their way anyway, come what may, because that's the nature of technology. And that they ought to sort of get themselves teed up about it, start learning about genetics. I found that reading genetics now is a completely different language. But a lot of the medical students now perhaps understand it very well. And perhaps there is a need for the older clinicians to sort of get involved in genetics and genomics very early on in their training.
And the difference between the genetics and genomics, which is subtle.
It is.
So what is the difference between genetics and genomics, then, Harish?
I think genetics is the study of how genes and how traits are passed down from one generation to the next. Genomics is quite different because it's a branch of molecular biology concerned with structures, function, and evolution and mapping of genomes. The two are obviously very closely interlinked. At the moment, the majority of medical students, etc., will be taught genetics, but not genomics. And this is why I feel that there is a desperate need for it being incorporated in training purposes.
Genomics is a much bigger field, isn't it?
It's a functional field, absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Which is basically all of us.
And I must confess, whenever I read the contents of genomics in textbooks, which I, being a nerd, I do every now and then, it's difficult to understand. But once you understand that, it becomes so obvious, this is how things are moving in the future.
Okay. Good. Well, thank you, Harish. Good to chat, and it's good to hear from Bala. And I hope everybody enjoys their next thought about precision medicine.
Fantastic. Thank you. Yep.